So, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm going to call this meeting of the House Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness to order for Tuesday, February 2nd, 2016. We're going to start the meeting with an organizational meeting, which all the committees do in order to adopt their rules. So I guess we'll have... let me open the organizational meeting. So, Representative Esquivel. Please.
Yes, Chair Lively, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated today, February 2nd, 2016.
So, Representative Esquivel has moved we adopt the committee rules dated today. Are there any questions, comments, any discussion, any objection to the committee rules? Okay, not. The rules are adopted. So now we're going to change the order of the agenda. So we're going to be taking HJR 202 first and then go back to House Bill 4098. So I'm going to open a hearing on HJR 202. Would you like to give us an overview?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, HJR 202 refers amendment of Article 15 of the Oregon Constitution to voters to require 3% of net proceeds from the state lottery revenues to be dedicated to benefit veterans beginning on or after July 1st, 2017. It expresses a limitation on Legislative Assembly's ability to reduce the amount of the percentage by two-thirds vote from 3% to 1% for no more than 2 years in a row, reduces the percentage from 3% to 2% on July 1st, 2050, reduces the percentage again from 2% to 1% on July 1st, 2075, declares emergency is effective on passage. There is a dash one amendment submitted by Representative Parrish, and it's posted on OLIS, that suggests specific services to benefit veterans, and it does come with a subsequent referral to the House Committee on Rules.
Okay. So, Representative Evans, do you want, like to start off?
Yes, sir.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to bring forward House Joint Resolution 202. Can you hear me? Just want to make sure that sounds good. All right. In preparation for today...
And who are you, please?
Thank you. I'm Paul Evans, member of the committee, representative of House District 20, which includes...
Thank you.
Independence, West Salem, South Salem. Also the one of the co-chairs of the Task Force on Task Forces Committee with Representative Huffman. Today, as I was getting ready... for this particular bill, I actually had an opportunity to think about a conversation I had last night at a veterans forum that was actually talking about planning this bill. And what I decided to do was I don't often dress the part, as some of you know, but today I'm wearing a purple tie because this issue isn't red or blue. And I'm wearing at least what I have is a black suit because it's a suit that I wore from time to time visiting funerals when I served Governor Kungoski as his military advisor. I do that because 14 years after we decided to go to war in Iraq and Afghanistan, our nation is still struggling with the ability to take care of its veterans. And while that is not a new thing in American history, it goes back and forth sometimes. We literally have five generations, five eras of veterans serving or living today. World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Persian Gulf era, and the current era. And as I was thinking about what to say today about the focus of this bill and how it will function, and I know this, all of the folks in this committee are co-signers on this bill. I know you are for this bill. But the message that I think we can send to the state of Oregon is that whatever the federal government may decide to do about taking care of its veterans, Oregon is not satisfied until all 350,000 veterans get the care that they have earned. And this approach, 3% of the lottery for a period of time that will then go down to 2% and 1%, like I explained previously, is a flexible tool in the struggle to leverage every single resource we can to try to capture as much of the federal revenues that we've earned. Just for, again, setting the stage, there are 350,000 veterans currently residing in Oregon, but only 100,000 are recognized by the VA. That means that the VA is structured and aimed at supporting those 100,000 instead of 350,000. So this bill will set aside money to focus on outreach, to help provide starter programs for partnerships that can help on housing, on transportation for vets, on health care opportunities. And the key thing that this bill will do is actually unlock federal dollars. I want to say that because in another committee not that long ago, it was talked about that one of the goals the state should do, and I think this is worthy of consideration, is helping people understand how they can realize the full measure of their EITC, their earned income tax credit. We're leaving $150 million on the table. We're leaving close to $4 billion on the table. And this is a method to do it. And we've tried to write it as carefully as we can to make sure that it can be flexible. During times of great financial crisis, the legislature would have an option of sweeping some of those funds to meet those crises. But in the meantime, we can actually focus on reintegrating this current era of veterans and taking care of those that are still struggling with the burdens that they are carrying. In closing, I just want to say thank you to everybody that's here behind me today. Some of them are going to be sharing their stories with you today. Some of them are actually going to be going to your offices and sharing their stories with the majority leader and the Senate and everybody we can get them to. I believe that they are, in fact, keeping faith with what Lincoln challenged us to do at Gettysburg. He went to Gettysburg to not only commemorate a battlefield, but he went there to remind people that the price paid had to be maintained and had to be kept because ultimately America was worth it. And again, I wish I could tell you that the federal government is doing what it needs to do for our vets, but we all know it's not. This is not the biggest thing. It's not going to solve every problem, but it is, I think, a responsible effort that the voters of Oregon will have an opportunity to determine whether we're going to keep faith with our veterans or not. And I just appreciate the opportunity to be before you today.
Members have any questions for Representative Evans? Representative Escobar.
Yes, this is a subsequent referral to rules. I hope that doesn't go down there and die.
Well, I don't know. It's a constitutional measure,
right?
Which is why, and it's being referred to the people, which is why rules get sort of an extra check on it. I think we should just be able to move it to the floor ourselves. But that's, I think that's why it has the subsequent referral. I think all of these HJR whatevers go to wind up in rules at some point.
Mm. Reasonable question. Other questions for Representative Evans at this point?
Not a question, but I want to thank Paul for continuing to work on the issue with me. We've been at this collectively for years, and this is a pretty good compromise, and we do have there's a dash one, and that's mine, and I want to explain it real fast and thank him for working to get that in there. But, you know, we do have a signature gathering petition right now out at 5, and it has this language in it. And whether that gets to the ballot or not, I want to make sure if this is the one that why we wind up with at the ballot, that it actually is has the same kind of underlying language about why we would do this. And I just want to briefly say that, you know, by adopting the Dash One Amendment, we are saying as a committee that we want the money to be used. We want to tell voters that this is what our intention is in using it. That it's for assistance for veterans with reintegration, employment, education, housing, physical and mental health care, and treatment of addiction. That it is for the assistance of veterans, spouses of veterans, and their dependents in accessing their state and federal benefits. That it is for services provided by local, tribal, for their institutions of higher ed or private entities, so that we can use our nonprofit in it and in this way. And Legislative Assembly may appropriate these monies. So basically, we are the appropriator. Actually, I actually see a tweak because they left off the Veteran Service Officer specifically. So I might even bring a dash two since we're not going to work this until Thursday. I will get with Legislative Council and get them to clean that up. And I'm just noticing that we did want locals and private entities, and really, it should say our nonprofits, because our VSOs are out doing this work. And sometimes they have funds for VSO officers, and sometimes they don't. If anybody wants to raise a hand, I'll send it to you. But there was a NPR article about the incarcerated veterans just came out last week. And in California, their program served 1,000 veterans. They brought back $15 million from incarcerated veterans. And that goes a long way. So that nonprofit and tribal VSO, those people are our partners in this. It's not just county and campus. So I want to make sure that they are recognized in here. So that line C does need a fix. I'm glad I read it out loud and caught that. But Paul is, you know, going to accept that as amendment to this, and And I just want to say, I've polled on this. The polling is off the charts. Voters want to vote on that, on this, and they're waiting on us somehow, either by signature or legislatively, to get something to them. But we're talking like 70%+ of people would vote on this. And even if they thought it took money from schools, they still want to vote on it. Because ultimately, I think Oregon's a state where we care about our veterans. We've shown that time and time again, except with the checkbook. And so, and this is our opportunity to do that. So I'll fix the dash one. We'll get it into a dash two. And thank you for accepting it in, and for the people in the room who've been working on that effort with me for since, you know, basically 2012. We're 4 years into trying to get this to the ballot, so in some form or another.
Chair Lively, Representative Parrish, the amendments are certainly accepted. I'd like to emphasize that when we passed the task force, House Bill 2838, House Task Force on Incarcerated Veterans, as we're identifying ideas and likely proposals, this could serve as a source of funding for those efforts. So that it's really a one-step, two-step approach. So, sure. But thank you again.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A few things. Rep. Parrish, did you say the reentry, reintegration along the lines of somebody that has been incarcerated would be?
Well, it could be incarcerated. It could be they're coming home from Iraq.
Exactly.
All of that's covered.
Okay.
But I gave the example of this program that they're doing in the California justice system. And interestingly, it's not a paid VSO. It's inmate VSOs. So they've actually trained inmates to be the VSO. And they're having to actually, unfortunately, do it all with pen and paper, no computers, and, you know, trying to do this case advocacy work from prison under really big constraints, and they've still brought back $15 million. And the interesting thing about, I think you might have remembered from Paul's task force group, is that when you connect somebody who's an inmate, and if you get them at the beginning, let's say they're going to be there for 3-4 years, we all know it takes a couple years to get through the VA process, but once they've been awarded benefits, they could use their Pell Grant, I mean their GI Bill, you can use that while you're incarcerated, so they could go back to school while they're in prison. A portion of that money can be used for their use if they had disability benefits. The rest of any money is earned, go, and I don't remember the percentage, 90% or whatever, goes back out to the families. And think about how hard it is when you've got somebody in your family who's incarcerated. So that's just one little microcosm of VSO work that's happening in one little tiny pocket of America. The importance of VSOs all over the place and different levels of where people would want to intersect with the VA, and sometimes it's not a traditional government VA, a VSO, we know that. So the bill really does, with the amendments, really will tighten that up and say we have the legislative intent is that the VFW, the DAV, any of these groups can come to us and say we would like some dollars to help fund our VSO work, and this legislation passed by the voters would allow us to fund that.
Follow up, is it legal, and is there a language in here that this money can't be used to supplant what the state's already investing?
We'd love to be able to do that, honestly, and we talked about that a couple years ago when we drafted, and the reality is if it's allocated for this, they could, and they did it with Parks and Rec, right? Like they actually, we came in and we said, voters said, here's your 15% and your 7.5% of that for fish or whatever, and we used that as the main source of funding, and we said we're not going to, you know, use a whole lot of general fund dollars that way anymore. For us, at 3%, which we'd still love it to be 5%, but at 3%, we're still talking about it's triple what we're putting in now. So,
okay. I just wanted to kind of get that
net,
out on the table.
The net on that is like $22 million new dollars, even if they supplanted the 11, it's like more $25 million or whatever, if they supplanted the 11 that we currently do at a general fund, there's still this huge gain.
Chair ahead, Lively, sure. To that point, in biennium dollars, the estimate is about $38.4 million if 3% is passed and captured and everything remains the same. So that's 19-ish million a year. One of the reasons we were pushing for 3%, quite frankly, is we expect some level of supplanting to take place. But even if it does happen, like Representative Parrish said, we're still ahead of the game by $22 million to actually work on programs. So that's why we did it that way. Certainly hope it doesn't happen, but sometimes things do happen. And that's why we went for the 3%, because, again, the need is there. We know that the return on investment is $1 in and $77 back. It's smart. It's economic development. It works. But we also know that sometimes budgets get tight, and we kind of anticipated that.
And just finally, and I don't know if Rep. Evans, if you can answer this, but maybe Mitch can nod to us. Are we currently training VSO type folks in prisons. Okay. Mitch Sparks from ODVA is saying no, we don't.
And Chair Lively, Representative Huffman, we're not, and one of the reasons we're having the task force discussion is to figure out how the best way to do that, given some of the legal requirements of maintaining security of Social Security information and other things, but finding a way to get more trained folks into the prison facilities and perhaps training others on at least one or two levels of outreach to get people interested. But we are working on trying to get specific answers for you by the time the task force is completed.
Representative Escobar, did you have a question?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question. Well, I do, actually. It pertains to this on the ballot. If we end up with a ballot measure, Representative Parrish and Representative Evans, if you'd be so kind as if this doesn't go through the legislative process and we do start collecting signatures, be sure and send that down to me because I have several organizations down there that would be happy to gather signatures.
I'll just give a quick update on the signature gathering piece. I'm the chief sponsor. Martha Schrader is my co-sponsor on that. Mm-hmm. And the difficulty is it's a constitutional amendment. It takes 150,000 signatures to hopefully qualify 117,000 of them as active. Oh. There were organizations out there who said, frankly, that they would kick some dollars to help our effort. And with the advent of IP28, which is the $5 billion tax measure,
they backed off.
They dropped off because they're out defending their business. So commitments that I had for at least $50,000 to $70,000 to help gather the signatures disappeared because of what else is on the ballot and all the other conflicting things. So once again, you got all these sort of forces out there that are precluding us from getting the signatures. So we really, at this point, we've collected, I've got about 400 people out there gathering signatures. They haven't come back all to me yet. So I don't know if we're going to make the deadline of July on the signature gathering front to get the 5% in. So if this body doesn't do this, there's a very high likelihood that this will not be on the ballot again in 16.
Representative Lively, Vice Chair Escobar, members of committee, if I could make one last appeal on kind of the macro sense of this. As we know from yesterday, this is going to be a very interesting 35 days. We know that folks on all sides of all different parties are trying to get as much out of this legislative session for different priorities and emergencies. I ask everybody here that if we work with our respective leaderships, R&D, in House and Senate alike, we can make this a priority and we can keep faith of the folks that are sitting behind us. This isn't a partisan issue, and we can't let it become a partisan issue. And I actually hope, and it may be a naive hope, but I hope this is one of the kumbaya bills that come out of this session where we decide, R&D alike, we can move it forward and not have to go through the expense of trying to fight to get it on the ballot because it's the right thing to do.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to say that I'm very, very fortunate in the aspect that I have two committees that when we go to committee, they park their partisanship at the door and walk in for the betterment of the organization in the state of Oregon, and this is one of the two.
Thank you.
Thanks to the chair, and same with the other one. Thanks to the chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Evans. I'm going to, at this point, call Cameron Smith to the microphone.
Good afternoon, Chair Lively, members of the committee. For the record, I am Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, also a proud Marine, and Marines have a rule of three in terms of every fire team has one leader and then three members on that fire team, and it works its way up the chain of command in terms of a general having those three divisions or a colonel having those three battalions. There are three main reasons that I want to thank Representative Evans and this committee for considering this concept of a lottery dedication for veteran services very broadly defined. And that rule of three does not change on the amount of money that we have to invest in veteran services. If it's a down budget, if it's a flat budget, if it's an increased budget, these strategies and these needs and these opportunities remain the same. And those three needs and opportunities for us at the strategic level are to target veteran services, to drive veteran engagement, and to mobilize partnerships. This committee has long heard about how we can better target veteran services. This is a shared county and state system that has existed for 70 years, since 1945, when Josephine County was the first county to stand up a veteran service officer, and the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs was founded. This is a proven advocacy system where the veteran service officer is that advocate and champion and fighting on behalf of the veteran and their family to access their earned benefits. Again, this is a proven system. In 2014 dollars, in terms of the federal VA impact, drawing down just on disability compensation and pension, almost $1.3 billion of cold, hard cash coming back into Oregon. That's over $100 million flowing back into the state every month. If we look back just a little over a decade ago, 2003, those numbers would have been about $455 million of disability compensation and low-income pension. So almost double the amount that we are drawing down over the last decade. In 2005, under then-Governor Kulongoski, we had a significant infusion of state resources, state general fund resources, to pass down through the county. That has made roughly $4.8 million flows down to county and veteran service organizations today. About $4.5 million of general fund funds are statewide training, claims review, and appellate work. That significant infusion in 2005 built the strength that we had over the last decade to double those drawdown of those federal VA resources. And we have a strong veteran services system, but we know we are leaving dollars on the table. We have roughly 330,000 veterans across the state. Oklahoma, roughly 3 of every 10 Oregon veterans access their benefits. So about 60,000 plus disabled Oregon veterans are helping draw down that $1.3 billion in compensation and low-income pension. Oklahoma has roughly about the same number of veterans that we have, 337,000 is their estimate. They're drawing down $1.8 billion in disability compensation and pension. So simply on the cold, hard cash, there is $500 million that Oklahoma is drawing down for its veterans compared to what we are leaving on the table. Again, that is not into state coffers, not into county coffers, but that is into the bank accounts and pocketbooks of our veterans and their families. It is a measurable, just on that one, Rep. Evans mentioned $4 billion, and I'll get to some other resources that we leave on the table, but just in terms of that cold, hard cash, now on average for a disabled Oregon veteran, almost $20,000 per Oregon veteran that we are able to access. That maximizes that drawdown of the federal VA resources and also preserves, saves, and extends limited general fund dollars to be able to more deeply serve all Oregonians with safety net resources. So that is the target veteran services. That is our largest opportunity as a state and one of our strategic pillars for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. That second pillar to drive veteran engagement, this goes to the outreach, the education, the awareness. We are building a system for all 330,000 plus Oregon veterans, but we also have some specific populations of veterans, returning veterans, our most recent veterans out of the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts. Just a Friday, I don't know if it was last week or the week before, we had the 116th Air Control Squadron of the Oregon National Guard come back from the Middle East. The deployments are continuing here 15 years. September 11th this year will be the 15th anniversary of 9/11. Those deployments for returning veterans continue, but we, as Rep. Evans mentioned, the four generations across five major wars. For Representative Esquivel's sake, I will not call our Vietnam veterans aging, but we have from our Vietnam veterans, our Korean War veterans, World War II veterans, 52% of our veterans population, over 150,000 veterans across the state, have unique needs as they age. Our women veterans, 9% of our population today, and the fastest rising demographic of our veterans community. Our rural veterans, yes, we live up and down the I-5 corridor in the major metro communities, but when you get out to rural Oregon, veterans make up a quarter to a third of those county populations. And as Representative Parrish has often reminded us in this committee, it is also about our military and veteran families. Across those five major populations, we have major policy outcomes just like all Oregonians in terms of our health and our mental health, in terms of our education and our economic opportunity that includes both employment, small business development, and housing. And we are proud of our core programs at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs in terms of our home loan program, in terms of our two skilled nursing facilities in the Dalles and in Lebanon, in terms of that claims and counseling. But we do not drive or control or staff or resource to meet every one of those outcome buckets. But again, it is an opportunity to draw down more federal VA dollars back to Oregon. On the health care front, both on health and mental health, $1 billion every year in federal VA health care resources that are spent in Oregon that could be better leveraged and better coordinated to achieve the aims of veterans and their families. On education, over $140 million every year of the GI Bill resources are spent in Oregon's universities and community colleges. We have never fully staffed or resourced to make sure we are getting the best value and graduation rates and launching these leaders that we have seen what they can do on the battlefield. We know what they can do when they come back home, if they get that health support, if they get that education and launch into the world again. To make sure that we are truly staffing and leveraging and resourcing employment opportunities from vocational rehab to out of business Oregon and small business development. When you think of the housing opportunities to really truly staff, coordinate, and resource to really maximize the HUD-VASH vouchers at the federal level to make sure that we are going more deeply to serve homeless veterans and those in crisis. If you just take one segment of those different buckets for returning vets, aging, women vets, rural, military veteran families, just on those aging resources from low-income pensions out of the federal VA, aid and attendance, caregiver supports, nursing care, not just at the two skilled nursing homes and the Oregon Veterans Homes, but across the skilled nursing continuum, and additional health care resources, it is an opportunity to draw down those federal VA resources and preserve the state general fund. This is everything we've talked about with the Paris program, public assistance reporting information system. Often we are serving these veterans and their families on state general funded programs, and we could be doing a better job to tap into those federal resources. The last, after target veteran services and driving veteran engagement, this is about mobilizing much broader partnerships. Our vision at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs is that veterans and their families thrive in Oregon. It is not going to be our ADFTE or our organization that brings that to bear, but it is a much bigger vision and mission than any one organization. When we have tackled complex issues in this committee and in other committees like unemployment, homelessness, incarceration and reentry, and suicide prevention, we know these are complex issues that are bigger than any one organization. It's going to take our fellow state agencies, local governments, tribes, the business community, nonprofits, and our service organizations. But it is this opportunity to bring the leadership of the state of Oregon, to bring these resources to bear. And I believe that the time for this effort is now. We have never had this breadth of a veterans population, this diversity of a veterans population, 330,000 across the state, men and women, urban and rural. We are broad, we are diverse, but we are also united. And I believe this issue unites us, not just in terms of funding and resources, but the creative and innovative thinking to bring to bear on very complex challenges, not just to model solutions for veterans and their families, but also all Oregonians. So again, we would emphasize targeting our veteran services, driving that veteran engagement, and mobilizing partnerships. And I want to steal Representative Parrish's line. If we can do this, a lottery dedication for fish, you know, we want to support our landscape and our amazing environment that we have here in Oregon. But I know if we can do this for fish, we can do this for veterans who have stood up and served all of us. And I would just end, if this is referred out to the voters, I don't think there is any question that Oregonians are going to mobilize and support it without one drop of advocacy on anyone's behalf, on yay or nay. This past weekend, we had a memorial service for Lance Corporal Ty Hart, one of the Marines who was one of the casualties in the two helicopters that collided off the coast of Oahu. And when you see the community of Staten and the Mid-Willamette Valley rally for his family, Staten strong, Hart family strong, it was impressive. Both sides of the bleachers, the entire gymnasium floor. And I believe if we had asked them, those citizens would believe we are currently dedicating these resources to better leverage this opportunity. I believe it's the right decision, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Representative Escobar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Cameron, I run into so many veterans that don't even know what they don't even know about their benefits. How can we, if we get this through, we'd have some money to do it? What kind of a vehicle do you think we should use in order to reach out to these people, all veterans, and let them know that they do have benefits available? I've had a couple of them that have applied for benefits because they've had their Vietnam era veterans and they have some side effects from Agent Orange. And both those individuals have received partial benefits for disability. But how do we get to we have, 30,000, did you say, that are receiving benefits? So that leaves us 300,000 or 100,000. So it leaves us 250,000 that are unaware of their benefits. How do we do that?
Chair Lively, Representative Esquivel, members of the committee, excellent question and goes to the heart of how we build deeper strategies underneath all of these three buckets. But I would say, number one is that investment in the veteran service officers at the local level. Your county is fortunate to have five veteran service officers and getting extensive, deep penetration into the veterans community to draw down those resources. The veteran service officers have that expertise to tap into the federal VA and be that advocate on behalf of the veterans, but often it requires them being behind that desk appointment after appointment. Investing further in their in the veteran services system allows them to better do that outreach to the community, whether it's to community colleges, whether it's to skilled nursing facilities, to be able to get out and make those connections with the community. But given the scale of this opportunity, to better serve veterans and their families, it will not solely be by full-time equivalent employees, whether it's at the county level or at the state level or out of the federal VA. So looking more creatively at outreach, what does it look like to have a vet corps of volunteers where we tap into the Vietnam generation that did not receive a welcome home in their own time? Not necessarily that we would have lay folks representing veterans back to the federal VA, but better connecting and tapping us into the community. It's what we've seen with campus veteran representatives, not necessarily submitting claims on behalf of veterans, but being that hub of the wheel on a campus to then connect into the referral networks. It is going to take both some investments, focused and targeted investments, but a lot of creative thinking to be able to do that.
Paul,
certainly go ahead.
Yes, I was thinking of, what about the World War II veteran? What about the Korean Vietnam era veteran that are out there? They aren't going to school, they aren't doing this, or some of them are retired, some of them are not. I want to be able to reach out to them some way. Now, I don't know if it's sending out a mailer saying, you know, you may be eligible for veterans benefits, or contact your VSO or something like that, but we need to be able to get these people's attention, because most people don't know they have any benefits at all. Mm-hmm.
Chair Lively, Representative Esquivel, even peer state agencies and within their programs don't have a great understanding of what the federal VA and what the veteran benefits offer. So when we've looked at our training program, we focused on training veteran service officers to help navigate that system. We would also look at, what does a training program look like for our peer state agencies, so that if someone's coming in for Medicaid or Medicare or other aging resources, gotcha, if they're coming in for food stamps at Department of Human Services, services, how are we making sure we're making that link so that it is truly the broader options that are available for all citizens? What does it look like for a training program for nonprofits? Many are serving homeless vets but don't realize the range of options that they could tap into. That training tool is one point of leverage. $34 million of biennium will not solve every outcome issue that we want to affect for veterans. It's going to be very focused, leveraged opportunities to resource.
DMV would be a great source because everyone usually ends up at the DMV.
Sure. Other questions for Cameron? Thank you very much, Cameron.
Thank you.
So we have 5 people that have signed up to offer testimony. I'm first going to call upon Jim Thompson, former representative Jim Thompson, if you'd please come. Once a representative, always a representative. Isn't that true?
I'm going to Jim Thompson, private citizen, unemployed, recovering state representative, things. But I'm here today, and I'm going to be very, very brief because I think this is an extremely important bill. My father was a World War II disabled veteran. He got pretty good care, but many of the people around him did not, and I think that continues on to today. People who are in the right position at the right time seem to be able to find the care and get the help. Other people are just plain literally under the bridge. This is not the solution to our veterans' problem, but this will provide us additional funding to go after federal money that we've left on the table. And so many of these people are in desperate need, and there is a lack of continuity between the veteran and the federal government, and we have to fill that at the state and county level to be able to, as Representative Esquivel mentioned, find them, first of all, because many of them don't know that they can avail themselves of these services. And once we find them, where's the file? You know, and I run into this all the time in my former district. I still work with veterans, and you run into somebody who's having all kinds of problems. And you know, okay, what are the veterans doing for you? What do you mean, what are the veterans? They don't do anything for me. Well, come on, we can do better than that. You know, so I can help plug them in. But we have to have continuity, and we don't have it. And so this is another step to try to get us to a point where we can build a system that will work. And we have more and more veterans coming home. The problems coming home are desperate. PTSD is going to be a huge issue, and we are not going to be able to deal with it well in the rural counties, especially if we don't have a system in place that can literally pull some of these people out of the bushes and get them help. So that would conclude my statement. And I think you've heard it before, but I don't know anything, anything to add other than, you know, we need to do it. It's extremely important. Yeah, thank you.
Yes, Representative.
Thanks, Mr. Thanks, Chair. Representative. No questions? And
okay.
I'm trying to
I guess you can't get up
here.
I
know you only have a month to do everything. You know,
yeah. I just want to say welcome back. Nice to see you.
Appreciate that, yes.
Yeah, so appreciate you making the time to come today.
Well, it's an important issue. Like I say, I'm still working with people that need these services, and I know them by name. They're not getting the connections they need to avail themselves of things that are truly available for them. But you got to connect them, and many of them are not in a position to connect themselves.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
You bet. Next, I'm going to call on Wayne Harvey. Wanda, is it Denise? Dennis?
Davis.
And John Stensland?
Davis.
Excuse me. Wanda Davis? Sorry. And John, you want to come on up? Whoever would like to start first, just introduce yourself for the record. And
I guess I can go first. Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the committee, my fellow veterans and distinguished guests. For the record, my name is Wayne Harvey, and I am the current chairman of the United Veterans Groups of Oregon, the UVGO, and the current president of the Retired Enlisted Association for the state of Oregon. The UVGO is made up of military veterans from 11 different veterans organizations that come together to present a unified positions on matters concerning the welfare of Oregon's 33,000 veterans and their dependents and survivors. The current needs of the veterans community far exceed the state's budgeted funds for the Department of Veterans Affairs. House Joint Resolution 202 with the Dash 1 and proposed Dash 2 amendments will help to provide the needed assistance to those veterans and their families that are most in need of the assistance. Given today's challenging fiscal environments, allocating lottery dollars directly to helping the veterans of Oregon will improve their lives dramatically. So on behalf of the members of these organizations, my fellow military retirees, other veterans and their families, we come before you today to go on the record to express our support of House Joint Resolution 202 with the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments, and ask for the support to move this bill out of the committee and through the Rules Committee, then onto the floor with a due pass recommendation, and hopefully with some help from folks on the Senate side, get this on the ballot to the voters of Oregon.
Thank you, and I appreciate how well you adjusted to the changing environment on the amendments. That was very good.
Thank you.
Next.
Good afternoon, Chair Lively and the members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to speak to you today in support of House Joint Resolution 202. For the record, my name is Wanda Davis. I'm a U.S. Navy veteran and lifelong Oregonian. Dallas, Oregon, and House District 23 is my hometown. Unlike the women and men returning from their service to this nation in the last 13 years, I served unscathed in peacetime and needed no help with my transition back into civilian life. However, it's too often a very different experience for today's veterans. The sacrifices never seem to end for them. They return to find a country that speaks its support in platitudes while these men and women languish on the streets, invisible to most of us. An average of 22 commit suicide each day for lack of the assistance promised to them. I've heard it said that a budget is a moral document. No matter how vehemently we protest that we care for our veterans, our budget speaks much louder about where veterans truly are on our list of priorities. Unless we, the people, proactively fund the services to meet their needs, we're telling them they don't matter to us. This resolution is a common sense approach to meeting our obligations to the people who earned the care and services we promised them. It would set aside only 3% of the undesignated lottery funds for veteran services and outreach. If the voters approve it in November, this money could result in as much as an annual $4 billion that Congress has appropriated for veteran services but remains unclaimed by the state. In closing, these recent wars are the first time in this nation's history where folks on the home front haven't really had to endure any sacrifice as a direct result of our military's participation in those wars. After all they've given on our behalf, I think a few state dollars to bring in a lot of federal money is a small price to pay. Thank you for your consideration.
Representative Lively, members of the committee, my name is John Stenzel. I retired out of the Navy with 30 years active and reserve. Native Oregonian, returned here. My dad was a teacher for 40-some years here in the state of Oregon. They've discussed the federal funding. What I'd like to look at is mobilizing partnerships, especially with what are our veterans organizations. I think that we're trying to hit that 70%. That is a way to be able to do that was through the AMVETS, Military Officers Association. These organizations have feet on the ground. They know the people in their communities. They're the best ones to be able to approach. And how do we bring those people back in to try to get those, whether it's federal dollars or who's providing the support out there? I want to bet you that every one of us knows somebody out there is providing support, whether it's dogs to help the, friendship dogs or ramps to be able to help people. We all know those type of things, but how do you get the funding to those organizations? And I believe that's one of the strong things you could get through your partnership was to engage those service organizations. And that would be the ideal way to be able to try to direct those funds where they get the biggest payback. And one of the things I believe that you should require whenever we do this is we have to establish metrics. The way somebody comes to us, they say, well, I'm going to give you whatever, we're going to establish metrics, and then we're going to evaluate how successful they were against those metrics and see whether or not they're actually meeting their objectives. And then we'll make a decision, make a recommendation back to the legislature 2 years later on whether or not we think those funds should be increased, decreased, or eliminated, or what have you. And then that would allow us to continually be able to start looking at new ideas and try to get ideas from the ground up instead of, you know, from the top down. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions of members of this panel? Okay. Thank you for taking the time to come testify. So we have, I have one more name, Commissioner David Brock Smith. So Commissioner, would you like to offer some testimony on this one?
Thank you, Chair Lively.
Welcome. Certainly.
Committee. Commissioner David Brock Smith, Curry County. I want to thank you and the folks that the representatives that sponsor this bill. As a county commissioner working directly with the VSO officers that really are the boots on the ground, so to speak, to assist our veterans within our counties and the state, this is a breath of fresh air. We have heard earlier testimony that a lot of the veterans in our counties and communities don't know that they have benefits. And I can tell you firsthand that's the case. More importantly, in talking with our different veteran service organizations that assist our veterans and our VSO officer, you really only have one chance once they come out, if you will, for help. And if you lose them, you've lost them forever, because it takes them a lot of them to get a lot of effort to come out and ask for help. And I can tell you with the current funding that we receive for our county, and we have the most veterans in Curry County per capita than the rest of the state. We're one VSO officer. He doesn't have any help. He has weeks backlogs and just phone calls and doesn't have the necessary support to provide the services that our veterans deserve. And anything we can do to assist that is greatly appreciated. Our veterans community in Curry County is strong with Vietnam veterans and veterans of foreign wars. They're a great bunch of guys, and they do what they can. But the cooperation also that was just testified upon is another aspect that this would definitely benefit. So I urge and respectfully hope that you support this piece of legislation and refer it to the citizens of the state so that they can support it as well.
Thank you. Any questions for the Representative Huffman?
I do have a question, Mr. Chair, probably not for you, but then I had another question occur to me after I left and I came back. But you reminded me of it, and it was, you know, the amount of money that Curry County might get to assist the VSO or whatever. Who would this money be appropriated to, and who would spend it? Would it be ODVA or?
Representative Evans, go ahead.
Chair Lively, right now the way it is formatted, because again, this is the referral to the voters,
right.
And then there's a statutory implementation piece that's the rider that. Once if the committee moves it, then that will move. The idea is that the money will be established into a fund. ODVA has visibility on the fund, but there will be rules determined on how the money will be spent moving forward. So yes, the short answer is it will be going to ODVA, but it won't be going to ODVA for ODVA's exclusive use. They're simply the first stop on where it would go.
I can tell you, Chair,
sure, Larry, go ahead.
If I remember our budget correctly, the amount of revenue that we received to fund our VSO office in Curry County is $36,000. And the only way that we're able to support that is, of course, that we have a VSO officer who is a veteran. Mm. And it's the best fit, of course, for the service. But he has no, there's no funds, of course, to offer him an assistant, an administrative assistant or anything. And so he's pretty overwhelmed.
Scripps and Escobar? Sorry.
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to ask, have you been able to take advantage of the allowances we made for volunteers being trained up and come in to assist then?
Yes, we have. And I believe it was in the 14 session where you allocated $1 million to be distributed through a grant program. We did apply for a larger piece. We were not accepted. The $10,000 was helpful to hire some short-term staff to come in and get the files in order. But this is something that would be much, much more helpful.
Representative Esco, you're okay. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you just said we had $36,000 allocated to your BSO for salary and benefits, correct?
Yes, sir.
Now, is that county dollars or is that state dollars coming down? Was it pass through or what is it?
Those are the federal and state dollars that come in to fund the county VSO VSO officers within the state.
I'm just wondering why we would allocate such a small amount when we allocate $100,000 per employee here in the state. I mean, am I missing something here?
No.
Go ahead, Representative Evans. You seem to have the answer.
No, yeah.
You want the task force on it, though.
Again, the size of the ODVA general fund budget is really not that big for all that they do. $7-ish million, and the packages to supplement the county VSO programs, I mean, quite frankly, Director Smith really deserves a lot of credit for he's been continuing to incrementally increase the amount of money flowing downrange to the counties to make that happen. It's just that there hasn't been allocations from this body to do it. So this fund would actually theoretically provide us significant abilities to enhance those funds.
So we're getting to the meat of the issue. If the buck stops here in the legislature because we haven't allocated enough money.
Yes, sir.
Okay. That's all I need to know. Thank you.
That was a great example of helping us understand the little bit of resources we're using and what we're able to leverage, but what we could if we had more resources. Anything else? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
For the time to present. Anybody else who wishes to offer any testimony on HJR 202? Certainly. Up to the microphone and give your name and address for the record, please.
CB.
I'm Jerry Murray, just a private citizen, and I was on CB Team 0417 in Vietnam. And I think this is kind of applicable, and I wasn't planning on testifying, but and I was only in the service for 4 years. But I was in it. We were in a combat CB team, more in a humanitarian role that worked with, we were trained to be like Marines, to go with the Marines, but more on a humanitarian role. And our team returned from Vietnam, and basically we were unwelcomed. Frankly, I thought of myself as leaving the country, going to Australia. We didn't even get debriefs from the military. We weren't welcomed home. But one of the things that I did when I retired was I reconnected with the team of 13 men. Mm. And we did have combat action. One of them had a Purple Heart. Of that 13 men, five are gone. And I know some of them could not re-enter the workforce. They had addictions. But out of that, there's about five of us left, and we now meet annually. And one of the things that really came out of it, some of them stayed in the military, and they educated those of us that had not stayed in about some of the benefits. And one of them was a Purple Heart, and he couldn't imagine that he had benefits. Another gentleman had stayed in, but he received a lot of issues with the VA, and he had very legitimate problems. But all I'm saying, this is as a Vietnam vet, And one of the things that I only had to go to one tour in Vietnam, and today you're seeing a lot of our men have to do multiple tours, and the cost to families is unbelievable. And I'm seeing the evidence of that. So anyway, that's my testimony, and I hope that helps.
Can I ask a question?
Sir?
I'm just curious, when you were in country and where at, where were you stationed?
Swan Lock, Vietnam. We were just north of Saigon. We were in our own compound and had to defend our own compound.
You were in Three Corps then?
Excuse me?
You were in Three Corps.
Oh, what is that?
That's around Saigon by Long Bin, Na Bay.
We were 45 miles north of Saigon, above Ben Juan.
Okay.
So,
and water.
I mean, that's some of the education. I didn't realize all of the prostate cancer issues, all of the issues that have really come up.
Diabetes,
yes. And a lot of that team. And I will even say with my father during World War II, they didn't know their benefits. And my dad's, he was in a squadron, and a lot of the people died of cancer. And I suspect it was chemicals in those airplanes.
Representative Boone, did you have
any? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. First, I want to say I don't believe you don't look old enough to be a Vietnam vet, but that's okay.
You don't say that about me.
Yeah, no, she's not talking about that.
And I just wanted to say welcome home.
Oh, thank you.
Long past, but welcome home.
Representative Evans.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, for time, I'm pretty certain they're not going to testify, but just for your purposes, if during a break or something like that, there's some folks from Home of the Brave, which is a local transitional housing program here in Salem. It's vets helping vets. It's one of the many types of programs that would be funded by this particular program. So again, they're here to answer questions if you want to, out of the camera's light probably, but there are some folks in the building today that would love to talk about those different types of leveraging opportunities if you want to.
Okay, thank you very much. So I'm going to close the public hearing on HJR 202, and just to repeat the process, so Thursday we'll have a work session at which hopefully the committee will adopt the amendments and make a recommendation to move this bill forward. Currently, it's scheduled to go to subsequent referral to rules, which means all of us will have to work to make sure we get it through rules and onto the floor. But again, thank you all that provided testimony and support. Now I'm going to open a public hearing on HB 4098. Cheyenne, do you want to give us some background?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 4098 creates a resiliency grant program funded by Article 11 Q bonds to enable distribution of state emergency preparedness equipment at the local level to be developed and administered by the Office of Emergency Management and Oregon Homeland Security Council, declares emergencies effective on passage. We do have a Dash 1 amendment that was received today, and so I'll try to hit the salient points. It makes a number of technical and conforming changes, of course, some additional definitions and renumbering. It permits distribution of funds to recipients, not just the distribution of equipment purchased with the funds. It makes the public contracting code inapplicable. It requires the Homeland Security Council to develop an equipment list by December 31st, 2016. It clarifies what is permissible with regard to the use of tax-exempt bonds. It requires approval for uses of equipment that are outside the scope of the recipient's business, and it requires recipients to indemnify the state against loss of federal tax benefits that are caused by the recipient.
Okay. Representative Evans. Seems like it's Representative Evans' day.
Yeah.
Well, good for you.
Thank you, Chair Lively. It's my day to actually work with some really smart people and get out of the way. So this one is, as it was a committee bill, 4098. We passed, or we accepted as a committee bill. 316 years ago today, give or take. 316 years ago today, plus a week, I'm told. See, that's why they're the smart guy. A seismic event that we still talk about shifted much of the world we think we know, and is the thing that we are living now in the shadow of, because we know that seismic events, especially along the Oregon coast, would fundamentally transform everything we know and how we function as a society. So my question today, really, before I introduce the brain trust that have put this bill together, which is Steve and Laura and Cindy, that will come up as a group behind me, is someday, when it hits, and we look back on what we did when we were in the legislature, the question is really simple. What did we do? And did we actually make at least a small difference with the time we had? This is a very simple bill in a lot of ways. It is an attempt to try to provide to rural Oregon what the UASI function really has provided in many ways to many of the metropolitan areas around the state. It is a force multiplier for local public safety agencies that will, number one, in the case of a catastrophic event, be brought into the fight, and in the days when there isn't a catastrophic event, give them the opportunity to benefit from the leveraged ability of the state to purchase equipment in good quality and quantity and to provide to the locals things they might not otherwise have to use to save life and property. The goal, quite frankly, here is whenever there's a catastrophic event, we're fighting the clock. This is a way to buy down the cost by providing pre-event disaster necessary equipment to the areas that we know are of highest risk and slowly start to do what we can to save as many lives as possible. So I'd like to stop there. If you have any questions, I'm going to actually refer you to the panel that comes up next. It is an outstanding bill, far more detailed than I thought we could get in the short time we had, and I just want to say publicly thank you to the team that's coming up to explain it. It really is an amazing process.
Great. Thank you, Paul. So, welcome to the microphone. Just introduce yourself for the record, please. And you can speak in whichever order you desire.
Chair Lively and members of the committee, my name is Steve Anderson. I'm a resident of Polk County, a longtime native Oregonian. And just a quick background, just not much, but a while back, a few years ago, I was appointed to chair Oregon's Local Emergency Planning Committee at a time when Oregon only had one. There was some difficulty with county and city and state organizations working together, and we worked out a program where that would improve emergency response community. At that time, I had an offer. I was doing some work with the Regional Maritime Security Coalition that was looking at the Columbia River and protecting the shipping interest up and down the Columbia River, and then was asked after 9/11 to work with a group at MIT and Homeland Security on some issues that dealt with supply chain integrity and resilience as it affected business and organizations after that event. So I've been involved in this area for a lot of my career. But after this was accepted as a committee bill, we went to work on it to address some of the issues. But first off, why the bill? We noticed that across the state of Oregon, there are gaps in emergency preparedness in terms of equipment. This equipment is not inexpensive, and it puts burdens on local budgets. The idea behind this bill is to use existing funds within the state of Oregon to allow the purchase and distribution of equipment into a area where it will be ready to use for immediate needs or whatever the local organizations deem is appropriate. It allows them to have access to it, but it remains the property of the state of Oregon. An important part of that means that if the Office of Emergency Management, who is administering the grant program, notices a need somewhere else in the state, they can mobilize that equipment and apply it to other areas in the state so that that helps them to be on the spot and ready to move. It requires that the recipients enter into agreement with the state to indemnify the state, but also to maintain the equipment to make sure it's repaired and operational and that they're trained to use it. And it allows the agency to inspect periodically, and if it's not being used properly, that can be brought back to the state. We'll take some questions in a minute, but just one other area that was read to you on page 3 of the amendment, it talks about exempting this equipment from the public contracting code. That's a policy decision which says that because a lot of this equipment has certain specifications, it needs to be transferable, it needs to be interchangeable. It's not like purchasing a table or toilet paper like that. It requires that it be exempted for that code, but it also goes to the public contracting language, which can be explained by Cynthia to me, which says that there has to be, let me just glass this out here, it says when the office, pursuant to this section, when acquiring preparedness equipment, pursuant to this section, the office shall use procurement methods that are impractical and transparent. That language comes out of the public contracting code, which means that even though it's exempted from some of the requirements, it still requires that those who are doing it take the best interest of the state and do it in a way that's appropriate. And so as after this became a committee bill, we went to work with Office of State Treasury and their support from Department of Justice here to deal with the issue so that this bill meets the intent but is satisfies the requirements in terms of maintaining taxes and sinus. And I would allow the individuals on my left or right to answer any questions today, and I will take any questions.
Representative Huffman, do you have a question?
Thank you. And I don't know where the decision came from, but what's the reasoning behind releasing it from normal procurement contracting rules?
Chair Lively, they can go into specifics of it, but what Steve mentioned about certain types of equipment that for standardization purposes may not necessarily meet the other requirements of a procurement effort that the state has for all of its general purposes. This is in some cases very specialized equipment. So what we try to do is get it separate from the DAS process, but still subject to the laws that DAS oversees and ensures. And the folks can actually explain it in more detail.
Follow-up. Mm-hmm. Is there going to be a dollar amount threshold that can be? Because I would assume some of this equipment can be quite expensive, maybe.
Sure, go ahead.
It is envisioned that the Oregon Homeland Security Council will actually determine through rules of the money that's set aside, how many projects they're going to try to buy and how much the relative scope and scale would be for the purchase effort. As far as what the state allows, the experts can explain that.
But is your question dealing with the dollar amount in which this process would be different than it is the normal process, or just the dollar amount for?
Okay. Both, Mr. Chair. A few weeks ago, Legislative Council, we adopted rules for purchasing for the legislative branch that can be different from what, you know, DAS, you know, normally has for contracting or procurement. So I just, something I'm always asking, keeping an eye on, so that
the purpose was sometimes in those cases the idea of a similar or equivalent piece of equipment might be recognized as the more efficient or inexpensive, but in certain specialty areas you don't want to switch out. There's actually a reason to keep it standardized so that you can change out parts, you can respond in a particular way, you know what where this button is on this particular item. Those types of concerns were envisioned when we wrote the language.
Chair Lively and Representative Huffman, there are some safeguards in place here too, because what it says is that we're not just going to go out and purchase any kind of equipment. The Homeland Security Council has a responsibility to develop a list of appropriate equipment that may meet different regional needs or local needs. In that process, they need to work with Oregon Emergency Management and the local county emergency management personnel. They will develop a list, they will prioritize that list, and then what it says is, of this is the equipment that we think is appropriate to meet emergencies in this region or this locale of the state, and that's the equipment that can be granted and be purchased. At that time, that equipment will have specific requirements. Then it goes out for the contracting issues. It's just not purchase what you want, but that there's a process in place to ensure that appropriate equipment that meets the regional needs has been identified, prioritized, and there's been conversations between the Homeland Security Council, Oregon Emergency Management, and the local emergency management community. So there's an agreement that says this is the kind of equipment that may best suit the seaside region. This is the must that fit the Burns area or Curry County or whatever. And then it goes into the process of procurement.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Next.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Laura Lockwood McCall. I'm the Director of the Debt Management Division in the Oregon State Treasury. As requested by Representative Evans and his staff, we've been meeting off and on for the last few months. Once we understood their policy goals, our job was to take the basic legislative concept and help them develop it in a way that we thought would meet the tax-exempt code. So that we can sell, hopefully, most of the bonds if this program moves forward on a tax-exempt basis. I think they've done a good job with that. And just some of sort of the things that we've seen, I'll say Cynthia and I both have seen in terms of other programs to help them be successful. And I think most of the changes that we've recommended, some of it's wordsmithing, mm-hmm. and some of it was concept. And I think we would both take credit that we suggested a shortcut to the public contracting code that still had the elements of competitive bid. But the technical specifications, we don't necessarily want low bid generators. I think we want best quality works in an emergency generator. So maybe that's kind of a crude way to put it. But that will be a big part of it. Under Article 11Q, which is the bond program that's presented here, the constitutional requirements is that either we own or operate. Mm-hmm. So we made some suggestions in terms of how to develop a grant agreement to allow us to continue to own it. It does have provisions at the end of the useful life of a piece of equipment that it could be offered to the community at fair market value. In some cases, there may not be a fair market value, but I think the representative's goal was to have them continue to maintain this equipment if we were to lend it to them through Lendlease. So we were trying to find the right balance of how to make sure people continue to maintain generators, water trucks, the other kinds of things that at least initially are envisioned. So we're really supportive in Treasury if this bill moves forward. I believe that there's a $10 million number that was built into the initial financing. Just completed the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission report. I think it's still at the printer. But the balance of general fund debt capacity that wasn't allocated last session is still available. and our ratios are looking good if the legislature chose to go a little bit above that. Revenues are up. Long-term forecast is good. So I think, you know, we are supportive, along with all the other very important things that you will be debating over the next month, that there's opportunity to pursue this program.
Great. Thank you very much.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, my name is Cynthia Burns. I'm with the Department of Justice. I represent the State Treasurer's Office and other state agencies in our bond sales. And I'm really just here to answer questions. So okay. If you have no questions, that's a good thing.
Do anybody have questions for members of this committee?
Well, just a comment. Laura and I hadn't talked yet, and Rep. Evans and I hadn't talked. Laura was talking about the stuff that she knows about. I actually already had the general obligation stuff spent, so I'm sorry.
I see. You could have told us before we started.
Oh, and any lottery capacity,
yeah,
too. I got
that. Have a little bit of that left, too. Revenues are up.
Revenues are up. Hope you don't know how much. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Now I'd like Mr. Stuckey, would you please...
Thank you, guys.
...come up? Welcome.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Lively, members of the committee. I'm Dave Stuckey, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. Pleased to be here today and to have conversations regarding resiliency and preparedness, as always. We have had multiple conversations here in the past couple of policy days, September, November, and also January. And so love the extension, love the conversation, love the bill in terms of how this committee is attacking issues that need to be dealt with. Echo Representative Evans. This is just fighting the clock. This is identifying some gaps that we have out there in existence. You know, from the standpoint of the Office of Emergency Management, we stand ready if this legislation moves forward to manage that. Office of Emergency Management deals with this every day. Representative Evans has mentioned USC. I'd like to extend that just a little bit further and talk about the Homeland Security Grant Program. OEM already has that in existence. They already collaborate with locals. They already have a grant review committee that helps drive these decisions, and the decisions are made by the locals in terms of where they want to see that money go. On any given year, it's somewhere between $3 and $4 million in Homeland Security grants that gets divvied out. 80% must go to the locals. The federal government says you must collaborate with the locals. So this rail in terms of how we manage this at the Office of Emergency Management is already in existence. Now, hopefully, this bill, if it moves forward, is not going to be like the feds in terms of a 305-page list of equipment that you can and can't buy. And so, but that does, but it's already there in terms of the staffing and the people. EMPG, we discussed this in September, the Emergency Management Performance Grant in front of this very committee. This EMPG is not going down. It is marginally going up. The Office of Emergency Management helps provide more funding to the locals than any other state in this nation in terms of EMPG. And so the only standpoint that we're looking at is it may take some assistance in terms of staffing and help to provide this. We believe that EMPG could be a portion of that. We certainly don't want to do that at the detriment of the locals, but there is that possibility. In terms of how we put, submitted it, there is a fiscal in there. There may be some concerns about staffing. Office of Emergency Management staffed up and produced the Seismic Rehab Grant Program. So SRGP is something that we have done before in the past. So basically what I'm outlining is that Office of Emergency Management can do it. It's in our wheelhouse. It's in terms of whether or not you want to provide that funding and the requirements that exist. And that's really what we have in conclusion. So I'll give you the 35-day short answer. Any questions that you have of me?
So second day in is quick.
Yes, sir.
Obviously, this does have a fiscal that's beyond what we can pay for with the bond. So that's just what I'm going to make sure people understand. That's why it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. And as Mr. Stuckey has indicated, that's not a major, but there are some resources needed in order for the department to add this to their portfolio. Any questions regarding that? Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Dan. Next, I'd like to call up David Hammack and Jay Wilson. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is David Hammack. I'm a resident of Salem, a proud resident of District 20. I'm speaking today as a representative of a fledgling statewide association of community radio stations, Oregon Community Media. I'm on the board, and I'm also the volunteer station manager of the local community, all-volunteer community radio station serving Salem and the Mid-Willamette Valley, KMUZ. Now, I'm not prepared, I apologize, to speak to specific language in the bill, but I do want to speak to a resource that this bill could assist, could strengthen to help better serve Oregonians. And that resource is a large number of non-commercial, public, and community radio stations scattered throughout the state. OCM currently has about 8 participating active members and another 25 stations either on the air or soon to be on the air. And some of them are very tiny and little tiny places. We range from up and down the I-5 corridor and from Newport, Florence to Fossil. Some of these stations will never be very capable in terms of what they can do in a crisis. But these stations are all stations that are focused on local service, and the ones that have either the sophistication in their volunteer staff or some paid staff all work closely with local EMS and public safety people. I want to give an example. I managed the station in Astoria for about 6 years, and in 2007, the National Weather Service won't call it a hurricane. I asked them, and they said they called it a big honking storm. But we had 120 knot sustained winds for days, and it totally disrupted communications, electricity, et cetera, all over the North Oregon coast. Our station had a generator at the transmitter site and a generator at the studio. We were the only radio on the air in 5 coastal counties for over a week. Telephone service was totally disrupted. There was no cell service. 911 did not work. You had to call your local fire station. Every 15 minutes, 24 hours a day for that week, we listed the local phone number in each exchange of the local fire hall so people could get help if they needed it. Fortunately for us, the county's emergency operations center was in the same dialing exchange as the station, so we could call them. We had to send messengers across the river to Owako to find out what was happening in Pacific County. This Astoria was able to do that because they had these generators that were paid for largely by a federal program that ended in 2011. The Federal Telecommunications Facility Program, the PTFP grant program, which built almost all of the public radio and television infrastructure throughout the country, came to an abrupt halt in 2011. So that source, the primary source for capital funding for non-commercial broadcasters, is gone. And that is the problem that we face. The community stations are not deep pockets. Our station, again, is all volunteer. We have operated for 4 years successfully. We raise about $60,000 a year it takes to operate the station. But capital is challenging for us. We have just managed to secure a philanthropic foundation grant to match a potential county grant to provide us with an emergency generator at our transmitter site. In our case, we have a transmitter, a studio, a transmitter, and a translator. The irony is that our translator is at a site that comes with emergency backup power, but it can't broadcast if the transmitter's down. So we think we're on the path to get that station, that equipped the generator this spring. But then the studio, if we can't originate audio, there's nothing going to the transmitter. So that's in our plan, and we will eventually do it. But a program like this could really enable smaller stations, the ones that are focused on local service and have relations with the local EMS folks, to be the partner that the EMS folks need in those crises. Our station is now an active member in a new group that's been formed with Marion County folks and Salem County folks to publicize preparedness. Our goal is to develop behavioral change so that having a preparedness kit is on the same thing as recycling your aluminum. We do that now in Oregon. We don't even think about it. Well, we want to get that. Our goal is to have that kind of awareness developed over time. And I will say, at our first meeting, looked around the table and said, why isn't Polk County here? So we're working on it. But these are the kind of partnerships local stations are involved in, and this bill could definitely help stations like mine have the robust infrastructure we need to stay on the air. Another, for example, this isn't a generator, but for example, we have grants outstanding as we speak to help us to install and have operating a remote transportable radio link back to the station, which will not only allow us to broadcast live from the Almsville Corn Festival, but we can take that radio to a future emergency operations center or joint information center and broadcast right from the EOC. We can have the county sheriff, we can have the whatever agencies are involved speaking to our audience directly. So I certainly encourage this bill. Again, there's going to be a lot of people standing in line for it. We hope to have a standing, a place in the line. We understand there are a lot of priorities and people who need things. We are challenged to approach like federal funding because we're not counties. During that big storm on the coast, I had the local rep from FEMA saying, oh yeah, we'll get you some money, FEMA money. Well, despite our record over there and his representations, we didn't get a penny from FEMA. And again, there's a lot of demand at the official county and city level, and we appreciate that. So these are the things we would hope to see. I would also make a pitch for the provision that the recipients of such equipment are obligated to maintain it. That whole week we were on the only station on the air, the group of five commercial stations out of the same building in Astoria had a huge diesel generator the county had given them, and they hadn't fueled it or maintained it. They couldn't get it to start. They spent that whole week crying to the National Guard to come fuel and fix and start their generator for them. So maintenance of the system so that it will in fact function when needed is a critical piece of this. I'm always delighted to answer questions about community radio, but That's my pitch.
Thank you very much, sir.
Good afternoon. My name is Jay Wilson. I'm an emergency manager in Clackamas County, but today I'm representing the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission as the chairman. I'm here really more as a relayer today than actively representing our commission's role, and so I'm going to read some prepared comments here, Chairman Lively and committee members. Thank you for the invitation to provide testimony for HB 4098. From OSPAC's perspective, we appreciate the role of disaster preparedness in the greater pursuit of resilience. I need to acknowledge that OSPAC is not responsible for reviewing the interchange between local emergency management offices and Oregon Emergency Management and the Oregon Military Department. We do not try to represent their relationships and current practices for grant administration and resource procurement and sharing. Part of the problem is that local emergency management offices are limited in their ability to directly provide testimony due to their jurisdiction's internal levels of approval and authority to represent at hearings, and therefore any testimony requires much lead time for review. That's really the reason where I'm here to relay comments that I was able to solicit very quickly on receiving this invitation at the end of last week, between then and yesterday. So I forwarded the materials that I was provided to a handful of emergency managers for their comment, and I would like to anonymously paraphrase their remarks. Most of them commented on the general support for the intent of the bill, but many of them had also taken a neutral position dependent on how this bill would actually be implemented. And so some general categories, I'm not going to read through all of these, they're available for the record, but nearly all of them commented on an issue of stuff versus staff, and something that many of them commented on from earlier bill funding programs through FEMA and Homeland Security that provided lots of equipment, but not the staff to manage it, to administer it. A lot of it went unused. So some criticality around how this funding would be balanced between the adequate staffing, both at the OEM office level and potentially impacts to staffing down the line at local jurisdictions, as Mr. Stuckey had mentioned. Where would the money come from to basically pay for this? Another concern was around the assessment of the needs, and there's language in here around emergencies that are most likely, in quotations, to occur, and an emphasis on having a standard methodology that ties into local hazard and vulnerability assessments that are already a current practice, making sure we maintain the way that we currently evaluate those hazards and rank them, and not adopt a different practice for that. Another comment was the administration. There's quite a bit of concern here around issues around contracts and warranties, storing and maintaining equipment. There was certainly issues also around this relationship between the public and private sector. These were just concerns, and maybe because of the nature of the language that was in the bill or not having very much background at the time. But I think in my testimony here, I'm just trying to articulate why I think hearing from local emergency management offices around their concerns is a critical aspect of this, and I'm wishing that there was greater representation or ability for them to do that. I do believe there is a letter that has been submitted by the Oregon Emergency Management Association, so I'm glad that they were able to represent there. In closing, I'd like to share a question I'm getting in various forms every time I give a public presentation on disaster resilience. Okay, so I survived the earthquake. Now, what am I going to do for the duration? And by duration, they mean the weeks and months that are going to be there. The Oregon Resilience Plan highlighted the downtime of weeks to months or longer that we expect to restore power, water, and other community services. We're pleased that we now have a state resilience officer to help orchestrate the recommendations from the Oregon Resilience Plan. But in OSPAC's continuing implementation of that resilience plan, we respectfully remind the committee that we still need to address community resilience in three following areas. Mass displacement planning for the tens of thousands of residents who are going to not be able to return to their homes. We need to develop a formal statewide occupancy safety inspection program similar to what California and the state of Washington have so that we can quickly reopen businesses and homes. We currently have hardly any means to do that. And what is on the Oregon statute for that has not been updated since 2011. And then we also need to consider investments in community health resilience for issues of access and management to safe drinking water, human waste management, and delivery of basic medical services at the neighborhood level. This is how we are defining community resilience apart from infrastructure resilience, and it's what our commission is looking at our direction to work for in the next this session and the next session after that. So thank you for your continued attention to Oregon's pursuit of disaster resilience, and I'm very happy to answer what questions I can.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Boone.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks. Welcome, Jay.
Thank you.
You might contact Linda Kozlowski on the poop management piece. They've got a really good program in Nehalem and Manzanita's, and along with a poop master.
Hmm. Is and that a scientific name, or is that?
Well, we went through that this morning. Okay. Too. I dealt with manure this morning, but they also have a lot of the issues you're talking about: mass displacement planning, occupancy, safety, etc. And so, I'm hoping that OSPAC will also enter into discussions with the new resilience officer and encourage him to, you know, use this opportunity to be the master of some of these plans while we, you know, get through this session and then getting into the next. So we don't have to wait, you know, all the way till 2017 to do things by law. So
yes,
it can happen. And I think I'll be meeting with him on Monday and see what he's got planned.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks again. We have two more people. Thank you for your patience from the counties. Commissioner Smith, again, thank you for your patience, and Patrick from AOC. Counties are a key partner in this effort. Seems like we rely on counties for a lot of things, so.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Singham with the Association of Oregon Counties. I wanted to point your attention to written testimony that was submitted from Tillamook County Commissioner Mark Labhart, showing our support for the bill. Commissioner Labhart is on our board and legislative committee. He's been a longtime leader in statewide emergency management, so we certainly appreciate his support. This year's been a tough year for Oregon counties in emergencies and disasters. We had some natural ones, floods and fires, and also some non-natural ones with the Umpqua shooting and the current situation in Harney County that all have required very intense coordination among all the counties and with our state agency partners. So I wanted to take a second to publicly thank the Office of Emergency Management and the Military Department, Colonel Stuckey, and Sean McCormick for their leadership and their assistance to Oregon counties in all of those situations. We always support any additional tools and coordination that allows counties to be better prepared for disasters, so that's why we are supporting the bill. I know one thing we do ask for this particular bill is Commissioner Labhart obviously couldn't be here today, but he would like to be here personally if there's a future work session or public hearing on the bill to personally thank the committee for all of your work in emergency management. Commissioner Labhart is retiring at the end of this year after 12 years on the county commission, and I know he would like to chat with you all personally. So he's been a, as I mentioned, a leader in emergency management for our association, so we have big shoes to fill. I think we found the guy to do it. And on that note, I'd like to introduce Curry County Commissioner again, David Brocksmith. Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick. Commissioner, or Representative Lively, committee, Curry County Commissioner David Brocksmith. There's no way that I could fill Commissioner Labhart's shoes when it comes to emergency preparedness. But I do want to support his efforts. He is by far the foremost expert and the person that has been involved in emergency preparedness amongst the county commissioners in the state. He and Commissioner Givens, who is also the
president of the Association of Oregon Counties, to which he has made a priority this year, have started a sister counties program. And that, so Tillamook County is a sister county of Umatilla County, and they are sharing resources, public works resources. Public works directors are coming over and touring Tillamook County and vice versa. I can tell you this bill is timely. I have a big hole in my county. You all probably have seen the videos. It's about... the estimate is about 65,000 cubic yards of material is going to need to be excavated out of that hole. Of course, I don't need to get into the economic situations. We're using county roads to divert Highway 101 traffic, which, of course, puts added stress on our roads down to the port of Brookings Harbor, which was never built to manage such traffic, heavy traffic. You know, you hear a lot about Curry County and being on the tip of the spear, so to speak, but I appreciate this grant program because one of the things that we've been able to do very well in Curry County is we don't have any debt, and so we can take advantage of these type of situations. As far as the emergency management, I really appreciate their office as well. I'll be declaring an emergency tomorrow. At our board meeting for the sinkhole and the subsequent issues that are occurring, and I want to thank Representative Boone for her efforts in resiliency and planning. Because as a member of the Coastal Caucus, we're in a situation that you heard earlier the testimony 316 years in a week. In Curry County, it's a little more concerning because if you go back and look at the emergency management materials, Curry County is four times more likely to have an 8.0 or greater event, and yet we're one of the last on the list for road construction when the event occurs. There's a number of different things that we're doing. Our public works, public health, and public safety are coordinating with our emergency management team, and we're working on resiliency and trying to get the message out to our citizens. But we don't have the resources for coordination, let alone equipment. And this is a very important piece of legislation to assist us in doing so, and as Patrick said, another tool in our toolbox to help us get it done. You know, and I would say that Representative Chair Lively, Representative Evans, whatever we can do to look at possibly weighting the resources for smaller counties that don't have those resources, that would be appreciated, because you know we don't have the resources of Douglas or even Lane County, of course. So when moving forward, if that can be a consideration, it would be greatly appreciated. Again, in closing, thank you all for your consideration, and a big thank you to Commissioner Labhart for all of his work on this. And I welcome to answer any questions.
Knowing that the resources in all of our counties, frankly, are strapped in that. So there was a comment made earlier about stuff versus staff. So we create this program where we create the equipment and stuff, and part of the expectation is you maintain and operate in that. So help me just understand better from the county standpoint your ability to be able to do that, even if we're able to supply the equipment.
Chair Lively, thank you for the question. Again, we the county doesn't have any debt, and so we're operating and maintaining our equipment now. We of course could always when you're in an organization running a county, there's millions of dollars in infrastructure repair and maintenance that needs to be done that you don't have the resources for. Our emergency management office does an excellent job with the resources that he has. We have some public works roads funding that could assist in this area. so we would be able to maintain the equipment. And as far as the not having going to stuff and not staff, it's important to understand that in our work, we don't have the resources or staff to get the message out. We try to have town halls. We try to have agreements with, you know, with other agencies for coordination to get information to our citizens. But it would be nice to be able to have some of those resources as well.
Sure. Other questions for the commissioner? Patrick? Great. Again, thank you for taking the time to meet with us. Okay, so I'm going to close the... Close the public hearing on House Bill 4098, and this bill, too, will be carried over till Thursday. We'll have a work session on Thursday when we'll have the fiscal, hopefully, and the amendment that we'll have to adopt.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this one, we have the existing amendment. It was Representative Parrish on the previous bill that said she would entertain a dash two.
Okay. We do have one amendment.
Is there a further amendment on?
Yes.
498. Okay.
They've identified one word that needs to be changed. It was an ORS reference. So
we can get that in and get that.
As soon as it's done, I'm going to find out how long we can, but we should be able to have it by Thursday, I think.
Okay. Very good.
Are we going to have a task force on it?
No. We're not. Thank you, members, and thank you, members of the audience, for attending today. Thank you, members, and thank you, members of the audience, for attending today.